Welcome. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. And tonight, we're going to be dealing with another, I hope, very interesting show, dealing with, of course, metaphysics and science in general, and also dealing with areas specifically of ageless wisdom, which is actually part of the title of tonight's show, The History of Ageless Wisdom. Now, history usually refers to the effects on people, and so that's what we're going to be dealing with, and specifically people on this planet, although it's going to involve a bit of people in other places as well. So, that being the case, so I'm talking about the history of ageless wisdom as it relates to Earth. So that's the best way to understand it. And let me begin by saying, it's sort of a preface, that when I'm talking about ancient history, going back literally millions of years, in that period of time, obviously, there is no recorded history. So we're not talking about history that somebody can go to the library and say, well, what was I saying? Because you won't find it there. You can find references from a number of recorded sources since, I would guess, what's left of it, maybe 6,000-7,000 years ago, going back literally to the Sumerians and the earliest recorded writings and that sort of thing, some of it, of course, in stone. But that, and there is ageless wisdom in it. So that is not the ageless wisdom I'm going to be referring to in total tonight, but there's pieces. And that's where most of recorded history has, is pieces of ageless wisdom, which, let me define for you. Ageless wisdom is actually an explanation of the Creator, yes, God, explanation of who and what God is. And as God has chosen to create the universe, how the universe works. So we call it both ontology, that's the nature of God, and cosmology, which is the nature or creation of the universe and how it's evolving, and how those two parts, God and the universe, it has created, interrelate together and with us, particularly human beings, although it has to do with other life than just human. Most of what people are interested in is how it relates to human beings. But tonight I will talk about, to some extent, other life as well. But most of it's going to center around human beings. So ageless wisdom is about ontology, cosmology, or about God, and how God is a creator, and how it even created itself, and, in addition to that, how the universe was created, and why, very important, and how life is a product of all of that, and the rationale of what life is. So all of this is what we would call the history of ageless wisdom, and it's represented considerably different throughout time. And the reason for that is that it is its purpose has been to, we'll say, shape the development of human beings, especially on Earth, and as humans change in need, ageless wisdom is presented in different ways so that the humans that are conscious at that time, their consciousness can understand, which is another way of defining consciousness, is understanding, what ageless wisdom does for them and is, and how it relates to them at that particular developmental time. The reason ageless wisdom changes is because people's consciousness has changed. And that's what we're going to be dealing with tonight. So it isn't like, well, ageless wisdom from 16 million years ago is the same presentation as it would be today. Because the consciousness of humans, the very earliest humans actually, was so much lower and less capable. there were people on Earth. And this goes back to well over 20 million years ago. And at that time, especially if you go back more than 22, say, and a half million years ago, there was a decision that the physical planet known as Earth, dense physical planet known as Earth, would be, as quickly as possible, populated with human beings, because it was the appropriate time, dealing with what is known as rounds. Time was the time in the fourth round, which we're still in, of life development, where humans could, if they were prompted to and pushed a little, prodded a little, become viable, livable within the Earth, or on the Earth. But the problem was that this was still the earliest. It wasn't the time when it was most opportune. Strangely, the most opportune time happened just literally about 10,000 years ago for human beings to have the best opportunity for development on Earth. So why make it try 22 and a half billion years earlier than that to try to make it work? And the answer is that because of the development of evil in some, in a couple of very distant galaxies from here, and this one, the Milky Way, of course, those beings were developing a type of evil which is considered more mentally focused. And if humans on Earth didn't start earlier, there wasn't a chance of at least getting going earlier, then the evil would have too much time to develop itself further, and planets were going to be in greater jeopardy that were in dense physical form, which is where God wants life to start and have the greatest level, we'll say, of effect on changing a very, very difficult part of the universe. The dense physical is so difficult because the forces that are created through not thinking in the same direction, which we call light, as God, creates this, we'll call it, almost impossible level of force that threatens life for humans and other life forms that humans have contact with. And this problem, this, we'll call it, this relatively statistically difficult problem, Earth was chosen to try to deal with, along with very few other planets, in other galaxies mostly, to see if there was some solution for what would be, in the distant future, a very formidable force of evil to come from these two galaxies that are so very significantly dark, and virtually entirely evil. And they that would lead to eventually galaxies like ours maybe being victims of the forces created by the people in a galaxy far, far away. And so here we've got an interesting scenario, because what is typically the way ageless wisdom is used is in a methodical, much slower model than the one we have seen here on Earth and which we are accustomed to, if not enjoying. And that's kind of a very good reason to talk about the history of ageless wisdom, because it's so atypical in comparison to other worlds. What we're doing here is almost in the class of unique, almost. And it is, it's a challenge, it's an experiment. The soul, that's us, if you think about it in the higher sense of who we are, came here because they want the challenge, and they want the challenge not because they want some kind of medal or something, They want the challenge because they believe they can help, they can serve in some way. So souls that are here are the better ones in comparison to others for this kind of experiment. Not better in terms of all other souls in development, but better from the standpoint that they're tougher. They're able to deal with the adversity and probably numerous failures from different incarnates. They also expect to succeed, or else they wouldn't come because they don't want to fail, of course. That would not help every other soul and the rest of the planet. But their expectation of success is not a guarantee. So, obviously, some souls do fail. And the souls that fail basically usually have several incarnates, at least two or more, that have gone evil. And when that happens, they consider leaving, literally, for a less difficult world. I know in the theosophical literature, it's usually pictured as some kind of world where people are more primitive. That actually is not correct, in my opinion. They may go to an even more enlightened world than Earth. It's just a lot easier. The world they may choose is in a slower pattern of development. Things are not going to be anywhere near as fast. It may be double or triple the amount of time and development of human beings. Youth. That being the case, they have a much higher level of success in those kind of scenarios, but we're always sad to see a soul that is tough enough to be here at least some of the time and succeed to eventually fail. That's not a good thing. But nonetheless, that's a part of this whole picture of the uniqueness of Angel's wisdom as it has evolved, so to speak, on Earth. Now, some of the things that are being tried are actually truly unique. So this is not everything. And this also means that Angel's wisdom has its special, sometimes peculiar level of ideas. And in an unusual act, we'll say, the beginnings of Angel's wisdom here on Earth saw the beings that are very advanced beyond human beings that control literally the development of the dimensional parts, especially dealing with the form parts of the three, well, actually more than that, all five of the dimensions that contribute to form, and at least the three that have to do with the development of humans here on Earth. Those beings called Kamaras, they didn't agree even how to proceed with this unique, or almost unique, experiment, and a disagreement arose that eventually led to abstention. You can imagine the abstention of Kamaras that were not particularly in favor of the whole scenario. Specifically, in terms of the human-related dimension, the Kamara that stands out is the astral plane Kamara. That's technically a female Kamara. I know that's hard for us to understand that there's a sex issue with Kamaras. In a sense, they are both sexes, but they may be more dominant in that element of themselves. And the Kamara of the astral world, she did not agree with the level of acceleration of both suffering and destruction that was going to occur through the model. And she was peculiarly, we'll say, influenced by the feminine side of things. She was more in that realm of creation. And for her, the suffering would be immense, not on a personal level, if you could imagine there is such a thing as personal, because there isn't with these Kamaras, but from the standpoint that to go through the immense amount of suffering that humans were going to have to, or likely would, something like that. Not that this thing's written in stone, but it's pretty clear it's going to be like that. Go through. She said, well, you know what? This is not what I want. I'm going to go be a Kamar on a different planet that doesn't participate in this. And you would think, well, there'll be a substitute kind of come in and just sort of, you know, do its thing. But that substitute really turned out to be one of the Kamaras who was not really actively in favor of the system, but was willing to stay on. And the strange thing is that Kamara was actually, by our language, was considered to be Satan. But not like a devil Satan. This is still a Kamara. But Satan said, okay, I'll stay around, but I think this whole thing, like my companion said, is going to fail. But I'll stay on, and I'm going to kind of prove it's going to fail before it fails, so that maybe we can still salvage the pieces. I know it sounds like a wacko kind of idea, but so his idea is to accelerate the suffering a little bit so that everybody will figure out that this really isn't going to work before the whole thing goes down the toilet. Which wasn't the idea. The idea was fail or succeed is not the issue, but find creative answers, even if they don't succeed, so that they can be taken up in another world if necessary in the future. This is a debatable issue, and certainly we could have an infinite debate on it, because who am I to say a Kamara is right or wrong? Humans in general would probably side with the idea that it isn't right. But the idea was that this being is free to do. And so when the opening came up, well, the astral world became kind of his proxy. But he's taking care of the physical part of things, too. And so it's a kind of odd situation. And so, right from the very beginning, you can say that Angel's wisdom was on its off balance, on its side, kind of, because the things that make up Angel's wisdom deals with how God created the universe. And one of those ways is that beings, living beings, some of them very far advanced as human beings, are in control of things like dimensions and all kinds of other stuff. God doesn't really do a hands-on. God has life be the creator, and God chooses to allow life to participate through God's wisdom and light, but not necessarily wisdom in terms of what we would call wisdom, but not necessarily as an interactor, except under rare circumstances. So if you look at the situation, this is freedom. That's the object of the whole situation. And if you're going to be free, you can't be interfering every which way. And even if a Kamara says, well, I'm going to do something, I don't like this, I'm going to do something different, you let the Kamara do something different. That's the way it is. And we'll see where that leads, you know? Because after all, part of the answer lies in the very fact that a Kamara would come up with that idea. And maybe the Kamara's even right. We don't know. I mean, you know, it's one of these strange things that we are faced with in principles dealing with Angel's wisdom, which I've talked about before. But historically, it's odd. I mean, I don't know if there's another planet that this has ever happened. So here we are with this strange thing right before anything even happens. We've got, you know, like godlike beings saying, you know what? I'm leaving. Another one says, I'm going to screw things up and see because this is going to go south on us. It's going to be really bad. I mean, it's got kind of an odd scenario, and it hasn't even started yet, in a sense. I mean, human beings weren't present when this took place. It was like the precursor. So talk about preface. This is like really preface. This is like even before you get going, everything's upside down. Everything is going in different directions, and that anything like known other planets. So this takes place. Now, where did the idea come from? Who came up with this idea? Well, one of the ideas, part of the idea, came from our sister planet. Literally, she's called the sister planet, I guess. And that's Venus. The Venus is a world that today cannot support physical life. But if you go back several hundred million years ago, the sun was cooler than it is today. That sounds strange, doesn't it? But it is actually true. The sun's actually getting warmer, not colder. Everybody thinks, well, if it was younger, shouldn't it be hotter? Yeah, one would think so, but the nuclear reactions that take place in the sun don't exactly work like that. So it's a kind of a strange principle. So during the time that the planet Venus had any life on it, and it did have life on it, it was not very different from Earth. It may have been a bit warmer, because remember, it's closer to the sun, but the sun was also cooler. There's also angle issues and other things about Venus. So when you figure it all out, Venus is a bit warmer than Earth, but not nearly as hot as it is today, warm in terms of just the amount of solar gain. The problem with Venus is, of course, it became a dead planet because it developed excessive amounts of carbon dioxide and other gaseous, cloud-like, thick atmospheric effects that trap heat. And so instead of being, a nice 75 to 85 degrees at the surface, it's 750 to 850 degrees at the surface. I mean, it's really hot. And so it's a totally, dead world in terms of the physical part. But there is life beyond the physical. And most of Venusian life is focused in the mental world. And Venus, the beings that were human beings there, have gone through the end of the fifth round there, so they would be coming back in the sixth round, as far as I know. That's my understanding. And their processes are so different from ours that they have, so there are two rounds ahead of us, by the way. This is the point, or almost 2 rounds ahead. But there's no life going on. Now, are they completed in terms of their full development? That's a whole other issue. This is my understanding of Venus. Venus kind of screwed up. It made some huge mistakes in its fifth round of development, and it actually not only destroyed itself in terms of life, but it destroyed its future in terms of being able to develop life. So that's a world that's really messed. And because it had some dark sides to it, some people went evil. And so Venus had a peculiar, we'll call it, desire, do you want to call it that? Or that the beings on Venus, human beings, would like to correct their mistakes. And part of their desire has to do with sharing what's wrong with them with the few people on Earth who can understand it, and also with anyone else that wants to hear it, as well as they want to make sure that whatever happened wrong on Venus becomes part of angels' wisdom in general, and eventually understood here on Earth. Now, of course, there aren't any Venusians presently on Earth teaching this. Although someone on Earth could go to the mental world of Venus and actually participate in education about it. Isn't that weird? And their emphasis is to try to undo or prevent from happening again what took place in their world, because they basically ended it. It is true that if Earth, now you may have heard this, some people believe this, but it is true. I'll explain. Earth develops itself to a great enough level, we'll call it, of consciousness. You're probably getting into the fifth round, which is several thousand years. It appears to be 7,000, several thousand years from now. Earth can go to Venus. People from Earth can go to Venus and clear out the clouds. And probably put a moon in place. And the moon would have to be larger than our moon, a little bit closer, blocking up more of the sunlight which would reduce the temperatures, and the planet could start to recover. We would have to literally be doing like Terra formation, because at the present time, the planet is constantly in upheaval, because it's like the inside of the planet's going to the outside. Super, super hot, and the mantle of the planet is still in a high level of agitation. So we could possibly change all that. If we did, by the way, there may not be much changes on the planet, per se, because then it might really settle down, and it wouldn't even be as violent as Earth. And it might not be a bad place to live, actually. You could, maybe over 1,000 years or so, you could actually make it into a decent planet. It would be habitable. So that's in their plan, and it's part of the plan of Angel's Wisdom. It's sort of like they're trying to correct the karma, and then in the long term, it may bring their planet back to life. That's why I said their fifth round, technically you'd think the planet's over with, because they screwed it up. Well, we might resurrect it. It's not as hard as that sounds. We might actually resurrect the planet. And it's not beyond the realm of possibility. There's a lot of things that would have to go on to do this. We might even have to put more than one moon up there, several of them, maybe. But because you got to cool it down. And they are close. And the sun is hotter and getting hotter. So even here on Earth, it's going to get hotter. So, you want to make sure that you make it livable. So just not get rid of the clouds, but it's still 130 or 140 degrees in the coolest part of the planet. That's not going to really do much good. That would be an unbearable place. Maybe even 180. That would be still pretty silly. But we could get it down. I'm talking about degrees Fahrenheit. We could get it down probably very close to what Earth is, and, on an average, maybe even be nicer, because a lot of people like it a little warmer. Not everybody, a lot of people. So, they like the more temperate and warmer places. So it would lend itself to that possibility, and that's part of the Ageless Wisdom, historically speaking, that has been thought of ahead of time. So the Venusians kind of came up with this idea as its originator. Let's get Earth going faster, and maybe they can come back and help save us in time. And at the same time, will be this great experiment of overcoming evil in general. And that's evil, the mental side of evil, is what did Venus in. So the same evil that we're dealing with from galaxies, the extreme distance from us, is what finished off Venus. And so if we can fix it here, we could fix it there. Because they still have got to have a messed up mental world. Their lower part of their mental world, in the fifth subworld, is still pretty badly messed up because of darkness. It's not 100%, because there's teaching that goes on there and other things. But it's still got a lot of problems. And so this would be a way that Earth could contribute to giving back. But the Venusians started this, the history of Ageless Wisdom, as far as Earth is concerned, along with people from constellation speaking, from the Pleiades, and from the dog star Sirius. It's a cultist star to us, by the way, but it's like almost a trinary kind of star. And then also you've got a couple of others. Some people speak about the Big Bear and that stuff. The Big Bear is being more of a fourth ray influence. Pleiades is like a sixth ray. You get all these different rays, the Sirius, the first ray. All these different ray influences, because each constellation has a more ray effect influence. Of course, there's seven constellations that are open. And so they all got together, these constellations, and a few more. And that's where the constellations also come into astrology and all that sort of stuff. And they all got together and with Venus and said, hey, now this is the advanced beyond human beings of Venus. They got to do this. Not the still people who are human, although there are very few of those. Most of the beings on Venus have there's still some that haven't because the world didn't finish. I mean, the round never completed. They destroyed the world. So you could say that there's quite a few of population-wise, probably 30-40% of what was the planet is still human. But they're stuck in the mineral. All right. So in any rate, the process as it came together is this. These 12 or so constellations. And there's some that are not included because there's some beings from other constellations are involved. Just don't think it's all like all set in stone, all one of 12 constellations. Now there's a bunch of other ones actually involved. But they got involved, most of them being superhuman, and they decided that the idea of Venus resurrecting itself through helping Earth had already kind of been through one incarnation and failed during an earlier part, and an earlier incarnation of the sun, when it was a much different kind of star. It only lasted 10 to 12 million years and destroyed itself, because that's what those kind of stars do. So Earth, it was at a super fast acceleration. It really only got into, humans only got into etheric form. And the moon is a representation of what was left of that planet. And that moon doesn't look all that like a place you'd really want to live. And you could imagine what they did to themselves. And it isn't very pretty. But they didn't make it. Okay. But that was when they were only in etheric form. They never became physical. Within a physical planet. There are etheric planets out there. And there's also life in worlds that are associated with physical planets, but the life is actually in the astral and mental world. So, and Buddhic. So, when we get into this area of Agent's Wisdom now, we're talking about some things that are so prehistoric that at the time that this stuff started to happen, in the beginning of it, the third round had just ended. And the only human beings on Earth were etheric, and they were pretty lacking in consciousness. And it was during that period of time that this idea started to be kicked around. But it took a long time before there was any serious possibility of doing anything with it, because the very earliest that human beings in an etheric way could be created by using an animal-type dense physical body in a human soul that would have the etheric body and the astral and the mental body joining, that the only way to do this was to wait until there was some animal, most of whom is the ape category, had enough development of the first etheric subplane in themselves to maybe mate it up with the human soulmate instead of letting go of their group soul, detaching the group soul's connection. And that was attempted like over 22 million years ago. Didn't work. Those almost human beings died out in weeks because they could not give up their instinctual behavior, instinctual thought coming from their group soul and survive. I mean, they didn't even know that they needed to drink water. They were unable to have any structure of self that they could rely upon to be creative enough to survive. And even if they were led around literally by the nose, which they tried to do, by the way, to say, well, do this, do that, they didn't have enough self to keep track of what they were supposed to do. And they ended up killing themselves. Literally within weeks, in most cases, and almost all of them within months. So it just didn't work. Now, the principle of Agent's Wisdom that was going on here was to first get them to start developing a contact, a connection between their etheric self and the physical self, starting from the first subworld of the etheric plane, because if you can't get the first subplane of the human being cannot readily access the human brain. So they were brainless, in the sense that they didn't have enough connection between the self, which is on the fourth subplane of the lower mental world, connected to the personality, which is three subplanes connected together above it, and that self was just not making it into the first sub world of the etheric, where the brain is, the physical brain. And the astral brain also is in the first subworld of the astral world, and there was little connection there. So there was not enough input. So even though some knowledge, a little bit, might be seeping through, it was shattered. It was disconnected knowledge. And a self with disconnected knowledge, even if it has a strong enough personality, cannot hold on to it. And that's because the access to the brain. So we have, it's sort of like not getting all the wires straight. And that's what the beginning of Angel's Wisdom was about, was trying to correct this problem. Well, it wasn't successful. So they waited another, let's move forward 18 million years, okay? And they tried this whole thing again. Now, obviously, the animals they're working with have over 4 million years of development. That's a lot of time to develop better brains that had more first etheric subworld development, which meant that the brain itself, the physical brain, was better developed and had not just a higher capacity, but the neurons were better connected together, and we could hold more information that could be accessed in a reasonable period of time. Time is a big problem, so that the self could think through it. Those people lasted a little longer. Some of them lived maybe up to 6 months, but most of them probably averaged 2 or 3. But they still didn't make it. Now, part of their problem was not just learning how to drink and eat and that sort of stuff. It was social dynamics. They couldn't relate to each other very well. They still thought they were just like the rest of the animals around them, and so they didn't know the difference between fellow human beings and animals. Also, their sense of God was still lacking tremendously, because the God comes from the second and first chakras. That sense comes from that, and that sense was extremely weak. Even though it was almost non-existent in the first try, it was a little stronger in the second, but it was still too weak. And so these beings couldn't see themselves as humans yet. They had enough sense to probably survive in a purely physical way. But as a human being might survive, you need certain social issues, and they couldn't possibly appropriate it and maintain children. So they were never going to go anywhere, and that was the problem. And so at that point, it was just a kind of giving up on the physical approach still. Now, you should know this. Before the any of these attempts were made, there was a first and second root phase of human beings that only were. They lived. They actually lived a fairly long time. But the problem was they never, ever became physical in form. They were living only as if they were human. And, you know, there's only so much interaction with the world around you that you can have when you're in etheric form and not in physical. As we know, when people die now, they're etheric, right, for days or weeks at a time, before they go on to the astral world, but how much did they have that they can involve themselves with? I mean, we're far more advanced than the first and second row races. Those are, you know, very primitive people. And their consciousness was low. So with low consciousness and almost no sense of the physical world, it was not much of a life. It was just enough to become accustomed to living in the first subworld of the plane and to developing skills at that, and then eventually to the second and third and fourth subworld of the etheric world. And that's good. I mean, the second new race actually got to the fourth subworld and developed a full etheric body. The problem was connecting it with a physical body and having a physical brain is very hard to do, because you have to have the first etheric sub couldn't happen 22 million years ago, and what certainly didn't happen 18 million years ago. So here's the problem with ageless wisdom. Ageless wisdom is trying to do something specific. It isn't trying to teach these beings about any advanced subjects that we talk about here. It's just trying to get them to be able to contact their first etheric subplane part of what would be the etheric brain, so it could link up with the physical brain, and you could actually have a fully thinking being. And that was what they were being taught about. They were given, literally, exercises 16 and a half million years ago to try to do this. And believe it or not, not all of them succeeded, some died, but a lot of the humans actually were able to succeed. Now, granted, they weren't able to sense that much from their physical body. Actually, proportionately, they sensed about one quarter of the amount that they sensed, on an average, of about what they sensed through their etheric body, which made their etheric bodies very large, because the sense creates the body. We'll hardly describe that tonight, but trust me, at least that's how it works. And so the sense creates what's going on, and so the etheric bodies grew immensely, like 50 feet tall in the beginning. And the physical body was still in the range of 7 feet or so tall, or 6 or 7 feet tall. And depending on the animal type there is, and some of them were like 8 to 10 feet. But regardless, they were nothing like the etheric body. The etheric body was just huge because most of their sense came from their body. And they even had a third eye, which is the Eisen Center, an actual sense organ there. That gave them sight, pure sight, in the etheric world itself. So they were living more in the etheric world than they were in the physical world, like their predecessors, the second root race, was doing. And a lot of them were having similar kinds of experiences. For them, that was normal, and they didn't mind it at all. But they still had some physical sense, enough so that they could actually interact with the physical environment, and most importantly, with each other, allowing them to eventually have sexual relations and to bear children. And that was the whole idea, because you don't want to keep making people this way. You want to start making a person that way. But you want them to engage together so that you can have a continuously created race of people, and that was necessary. And so you can begin, as I described it, that you need then for the humans themselves to procreate and expand the race in terms of numbers and eventually in consciousness. So once that took place, you could say that the first Lemurian subrace was created about 16 million years ago, give or take. And these beings were extremely etheric, but they were taught ageless wisdom based upon that idea. How to change the etheric body in relationship to the physical. In this case, reduce the etheric senses and increase the physical senses. And they were taught principles in ageless wisdom that contributed to that very idea. Now, they were taught some other things about ageless wisdom as well, but that was a biggie. And so they were first taught what to do and eventually why they were doing it. And as they gained a better understanding of consciousness, about why they were doing it, their senses grew considerably, and so did their self, because the self is the part of us that is consciously understanding. And so you had a better balance then between the self and what would be considered the personality, and also the senses were starting to rebalance. So the people, in terms of etheric size, started to shrink, and instead of being giant, 50 feet tall people, you had 25, and eventually 15, and then eventually 10, and then eventually the etheric body, which is only a few inches outside of the physical body, became the norm, but that took a long time. Actually, that took about close to 8 million years for that to be accomplished. And it went through more than one of the sub-root races. Now, I mean, it's pretty amazing. So the first sub-root race was taught mostly about how to create well, in the first right now, how to create a more normal, balanced body, or bodies, we're talking about the spirit and physical. They were taught also how to relate their feelings, which is the astral body, to the brain of the astral body, and connect that as best as they could with their physical body, so they could relate their feelings to also their physical sensations. This allowed them to gain, we'll say, a closer relationship with other humans. And then this was then the dominant element of how Angel's Wisdom was taught to the second sublights. They became almost masters at that particular idea. They really got good at it, so to speak. And they did more to, we'll say, develop relationships among themselves than they did with their environment or their world around them. They weren't that greatly successful at building up a civilization or a society in terms of technology or things. They were much better about their ability to communicate with each other and to build a relationship with each other that was sustained. They learned to become monogamous. They learned to, and they understood why monogamous, but they understood principles of Aegis wisdom and how there was benefits to be gained and many losses if you didn't. And so this was a major part of their, we call it, education. And eventually, this all changed around so that you could say that there was a significant improvement in the sub-race, the second sub-race of the Lemurians. I've gone way past my time here as I look at the clock. I'm so wrapped up in this, I'm not even looking. You know what? We're about 8 minutes late. But we can go ahead and have a break. I hope that our engineer has fallen asleep waiting for me to do this. And we'll come back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Thank you.
flower. Tonight we're talking about the history of ageless wisdom. And I've never done a show on the history of ageless wisdom. I've done principles of ageless wisdom and talked about ageless wisdom up and down every different way. But I haven't really talked about it historically speaking. History is different than talking about, well, concepts, we'll say. History is about how it relates to, in this particular case, mostly human beings. And in our case, it's mostly prehistory, because a lot of this stuff isn't written down anywhere. And unless you read books I've written on it, some of it is there. And it's in pieces in various other places. You can find little pieces here and there and around. But you won't find the whole thing kind of explained. Okay, so let's continue on, because I kind of got wrapped up there, let's say. And finally, as the etheric senses started to balance with the physical senses, and human beings were now proportional, their etheric bodies were about the same size as their physical bodies, as they should be, a little bit bigger, and it was time for humans to pay more attention to what would be considered third-ray activities. And ageless wisdom was really dramatically changed kind of how it was taught, because now most of the teaching was in how to deal with the three lower kingdoms, animals, plants, minerals, with an emphasis actually on minerals and plants for the Lemurians. And they were taught how to best use and help these kingdoms at the same time, and make them an extension of the senses of and bodies of the Lemurians themselves, and keep respect for those kingdoms. That was a big deal, and that was the third sub-race of Lemurians, and they were pretty good at it. They were very successful at that part of it. They learned a lot about how to better communicate with each other. They were able to communicate at pretty far distances, using several different methods that we're familiar with, everything from smoke signals to reflected light and sounds, drums, and that sort of thing. They were able to literally replicate most of the ways that we have had in our recent times, but at a much earlier time than we would have considered, because this is 8+ million years ago. It started about 8.5 million years ago. And that's a huge time gap between what is presently believed by the majority, we'll say a paleontologist and anthropologist. They don't believe that that there really is, really were human beings until very, very recently. Most of the human beings that they even think were our primitive ancestors were actually degenerated people from the majority, from the race after the Lemurians, because the Lemurians themselves, when they disappeared, were unfortunately, we'll say, disintegrated for the most part. And we don't have much evidence of their existence, but of their de-evolved species, we do have. And some of them have been found to be 7 million years old, and they're more advanced than the species of 3.5 million years ago. What? Yeah, that's true. You do your homework on that. They discovered that within the last few years. And, of course, it turns evolution upside down. Now, you can say, well, how come that be? Well, because they're de-evolving. And so it is the upside down of evolution. But right now, de-evolution is not considered in most evolutionist viewpoints as being right. And so, if they even know about it. And that's the reason for the confusion. So, and that's the reason nobody's looking that far back for actual human beings. Again, it'll be hard to find any Lemurians because they have all basically disappeared. They were either absorbed into the Atlantean race, which came after, but trying to stick with the Lemurians first, they mostly were destroyed. They were either destroyed because they de-evolved and then became literally more animal-like, less like themselves, not necessarily more etheric like the earlier parts of them, but definitely more animal-like. And then the other thing that happened was that they were destroyed because their continent was inundated. Inundated because it fell through the ocean floor in one of the ridges into the Pacific Ocean. And they were in the southern part of the Pacific Ocean. They just, the whole continent disappeared and wiped out the majority, but not every Lemurian. Some of the Lemurians actually were absorbed into the Atlantean earlier sub-races. They actually lived with them and eventually had children, offspring with them. So it's we shouldn't consider them completely obliterated, but their culture is very hard to find any remnants of. And that's the problem. So all of this great civilization that I was talking about, the third sub-race developed, there's virtually nothing around to be found to prove that they existed. And that's going to probably remain that way. I don't think, unlike with the Atlanteans, the later Atlanteans, we're going to find some things about them. But the Lemurians, because of the time problem and the changes on Earth, is not likely to happen. We went through many ice ages. We changed. The Earth was in upheavals here and there during the time. And it was it probably wasn't good for them. Now, the continent of Lemuria can be found still in the mantle of the Earth. They have recently, last few years, discovered that it exists there, along with the Atlantean continent, which has slid underneath parts of Africa. Isn't that amazing? Wow. And they are exactly where they should be based upon the movement of the mantle, which is now identifiable, and approximately when they were submerged. Just amazing stuff. So we're really getting close to actually physically proving a lot of the things, if not already have done so, that I wrote about and other people have written about from Ageless Wisdom. Okay. And Ageless Wisdom is a living historical thing. As we discover more, we learn how to interpret what we previously knew. So the wisdom is coming from it in a growing sense, because nothing we know to be true today that I know of was 100% that way. If you go back to the Lemurian time, everything is in an evolutionary state. Truth is really based upon our understandings. If we don't have the consciousness to see all the connections, we understand something that is incomplete. Okay, so the Lemurians did a pretty fine job, actually, in developing the third race. These beings were huge people, by the way. They could stand 8 to 9 feet tall, the men were, and they were big, huge people, probably as big as human beings have ever been in a physical sense. And they were also big when they were in etheric form as well. Their etheric bodies were even more huge. And the stone figures that have been built, you know, in some places, that resemble these Lemurians are an attempt to replicate what they really look like. And so they made them big because they were big. Bigger than people are today. Now, some people claim, well, you can't make a human being that big because proportionally they won't be able to move, they won't be able to do this, they won't be able to... You know, that isn't true. I mean, that was the thinking in the 60s and 70s. Because we just didn't understand that the nature of a human being doesn't have to always adhere to exactly the same ratios of muscle and bone. There's a lot of things you can change to compensate for size. As a matter of fact, getting bigger is one of the easiest things, and getting smaller is even easier, of any kind of living form. It's one of the easiest things to change. And so, yes, if you get too big with some types of structure form, it may not work. I think that it's possible if you get over physically 10, 12 feet tall, being on two legs with little feet and that kind of thing might be a real big problem. But then you might be on two legs with huge feet or some other way of restructuring the body so it can rebalance itself and be able to survive these things. And, of course, women always have the unique problem of the way they give birth which requires that the hips be in a position which is not anatomically the easiest thing for them. But so that also enters into the situation if you're going to have very big people. But then again, you know, the interesting thing is very big people don't have to have proportionally the same size babies. They could have small babies that just grow faster and get bigger. So the idea that you have to have a proportionate sized baby is not true. Okay. So let's go to the ageless wisdom then changed. Going into the fourth sub-race of the Lemurians, this was a period of time when the ageless wisdom started to turn more reflectively inward, where the expression coming from the person was not just to build something on the outside, but to take something that was created from the inside and be able to express it with more finesse and connect it in ways that we call art, the expression of soul and with form, spirit and form, together was the emphasis of ageless wisdom as it was taught to the fourth sub-race, Lemurians. And again, these were still very animalistic kinds of people that had not really developed much in the way of art. And even though the third sub-race developed minor kinds of art, this was a race that really bloomed in that realm. And so the spirit part of them became much more visible, both in their art form, in their expressions to each other, in their living together, too. They wanted to incorporate principles of ageless wisdom that were taught to them in the way that they lived. One of the conflicts they had was whether or not to always be monogamous or to live a polygamous lifestyle. And that kind of became a fairly big, we'll say, issue. Some Lemurians chose to be communal, and others chose to be what we would consider to be at least mostly monogamous. The issues of this sort have to do with understanding God and spirit and being able to relate it to the more structural elements of sexuality and the full nature of existence itself, and being able to see how they interrelate, and also being able to change the feelings of the astral nature more into a higher, or we'll call it, unconditional form of love, that may be even a universal eventually, but at least an unconditional form of love. And once you get unconditional love, monogamy is a natural state, but as long as you keep conditional elements to love, then monogamy is not natural. And it could be achieved, but only with force, either from the inner self or from society with laws and kind of stuff like that. So the Lemurians had a very big time, a very tough time with this. This is really the crux of the issue. They learned a lot more about ageless wisdom in the process because it was taught to them to reveal for them the problems that they were having and how they could resolve them. Unconditional love is a seriously, we'll say, tough problem. We just, because our personality is foolish about it, do we think that we're loving all the time, when we may be really only partly loving and partly taking? And we fool ourselves about it. We mask from ourselves the amount that we're selfishly trying to get something while we supposedly, and really are probably, giving. But the problem is that if you aren't giving completely, when you're sexually involved with someone, particularly of the opposite sex, the result is that the processes that allow you to become other-directed and concerned about others as much or more than yourself are stunted. They're blocked. And so polygamy and worse, just helter-skelter sexual whatever, has a disruption to the ability to become other-directed and to understand and feel what other people are in a truly called super empathic way, and to connect this with the spiritual meaning of God. These things are very important things that the fourth Lemurian subrace struggled with, and that Ageless Wisdom helped them to get around. Also, homosexuality does even more of that screw up, because the homosexual issue is that you're reversing energies from male-female back and forth in sex to be able to discover unconditional love. The problem is that you can't do that if you're homosexual, because the energies are the same sex, so whether male or female. And so the results then become that you can develop what we'll call conditional love, but you can't really develop unconditional love, which is the love that ultimately leads to monogamy. So monogamy becomes strained and forced and difficult when people are homosexual. But the worst part of it is that each pays a penalty in lacking love, especially unconditional love. But it also truncates even conditional love over time. Because love is, the more you're conditional with the love, it isn't just balancing and say, well, I'll just keep that level. It's always eroding some of the love in the wrong balance towards selfishness. And no matter how you try to compensate in other ways, which is what many people do that are homosexual, they seldom, it's like treading water, they seldom get very far with that. They may remain the same, but they can't get more development going. And that's a problem. So it is an important element, and that's one of the things the fourth subrace of Lemurians were trying to achieve. They, some did and some didn't. That's the way it is. You know? And so that part of the history of Ageless Wisdom has a checkerboard to it. It's not 100%. But it was a good start, because remember, this is the seventh, the third subrace, but it's a race that was focused from the seventh ray of focus. And it has a totally different kind of feeling to it, you might call it that. Whereas the Atlanteans were more focused with the fifth ray as an emphasis in their development, it really is a totally kind of different way of looking at it. Now, I know a lot of people say, I thought the sixth ray was on the Lemurians. And yeah, everybody's confused about that. I know that. The idea here is that the Lemurians were struggling with the seventh ray because it was about their physical seventh ray body. That was the emphasis of their development. Whereas the Atlanteans were really at a point where they got that part figured out because of Lemurians, and they adopted some of that because some of those Lemurians literally became part of their world, and they were able to move ahead and develop at least a majority of the astral nature, which is a sixth ray focus. That's where the ray focus is coming. All right, so at any rate, getting back to, again, this concept of historical elements of Ageless Wisdom, by the time that we are now going past the fourth subrace of Lemurians, the majority of, we'll call it, interactions with people who were beyond human was coming from the Venusian realm. And because they were so fifth ray oriented, that's where they had a lot of focus. The planet Venus was along the fifth ray, Earth is focused along the third ray. And so they could come in and give more assistance. And therefore, some of these beings that were coming frequently from literally tens to hundreds of light years away constellations, they were less frequently interacting with humans on Earth. And so you had more Venusian super beings that were involved in some of the training and helpfulness of teaching Ageless Wisdom. So there was a little bit of a shift, you could call it, in the way that Ageless Wisdom was taught. When you go from the fourth subrace of Lemurians to the fifth, because the Lemurians were more amenable to the fifth ray at that point, and the Venusians, there they were, very strongly fifth ray folks. And they thought they could do a better job, and of course they probably could, because they had a much closer realm. It was much easier for them to access Earth. In order to get to Earth from most of these star systems and constellations, you've got to go through the mental world, and the higher mental world, and then recreate everything down from that point. You can do it. It just takes a bit more, and the beings have to be even more advanced, by the way. And that's good that they're more advanced, but they don't relate as well to the human nature. And it's better that you get someone closer to humans than someone who's so far advanced that they haven't been there in so long. It's not easy for them to completely relate to these lowly Lemurians who are, you know, just a notch or two above animals and many of their mannerisms and the way of living and that kind of stuff. They were human. They had individual souls. They had connection to their creator. They had the heart and crown chakras developed with consciousness. So they're human, but pretty primitive. All right, so the Venusians were now more in focus. And some of them came and started an actual hierarchy of their own on the physical planet, and they were the originators of what people would call the spiritual hierarchy of Earth. They were from the spiritual hierarchy of Venus. I mean, literally. And so, at the fifth subrace of the Lemurians now, you kind of have a shift. And because the spiritual hierarchy is coming from all the other various constellations and planets from those constellations, each had a little different flavor, different this and that. And you're throwing in a lot of stuff. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. But it was more eclectic. Now you've suddenly got a very concentrated kind of, we'll call it, focus of ageless wisdom. The focus is much more monastic, and it's more coming from those who have a stake in the game. Because remember, if Earth could or would improve itself enough, we're talking about millions of years there, sure, I got it, but that's nothing in the scheme of things. The humans of Earth could save Venus. I might say, and I don't want you to think this, that these super beings from Venus came here with such a selfish intention. They want to save Venus because it's part of the whole system of the sun, it's part of God, it's part of everything. And to throw away a planet is a big deal. They don't want to save it because, yeah, I'd like to have my planet back. We screwed it up, but maybe Earth can fix it. No, that's not what they were doing. But it sounds like that when I say it that way, so I have to be careful. These are still superhumans. They are advanced beyond where we are today, but not much, just a little bit. But still very far advanced from the Lemurians. So that's pretty far. And so they come in, and again, their focus is more centralized around monastic development, although they certainly understand the principles that the Lemurians were etheric and physical and mental was still a small part of their development. So they start bringing in a little more mental, and of course the fifth subrace of Lemurians was focused more mentally. Anyway, and There's an immediate, identification, better identification with these folks. And this is we're talking about, we're already in the 6 to 7 million year range. And the good news is that during that period of time, the Lemurians were actually doing rather well. I mean, they had all kinds of civilized developments and things that we would consider almost identifiable as, like, wow, that's humans that are doing their thing. They were also becoming a little more violent and problematic. It always had some struggles among themselves, and it would cause conflicts. But they decided that, well, now that we got everything straight here in Lemuria, let's see what's out there, and maybe we could go visit some other humans and see what we could do with them. And so they did that, and initially they did it just more for exploration, because fifth subrace beings love to explore. It's like their thing. It's part of the fifth ray. They're very curious. They want to find out what's over the mountain, over the ocean, over the ridge, just get over them. And so they did, and they discovered the beginnings of Atlantis. But they also discovered that they were more advanced at that time than the beginning Atlanteans in a number of ways. And they were also physically more competent and bigger and stronger. This gave them some advantages that they sometimes abused, but most of the time they just traded, but they sometimes took advantage from their just superior position. The Atlanteans were not great sailors at that time, whereas the Lemurians were actually not too bad at it. The big part of this whole thing is that the influence of the ageless wisdom as coming from the Venusian style of it was a little bit ignorant, maybe even selfish, in the astral realm. Now, why was that? Because these are supposedly super beings, right? Well, yes, but remember, they came from a failed world. Even though they succeeded, they must have planted the seed somewhere so the others didn't succeed. So they created from their lack of attention to the growing humanity below them that wasn't doing too well, some way of helping that humanity recover and stop the world from being destroyed, which they didn't do. So they come here to Earth, and they still carry with them some of these misapplied deeds and ideas. And it actually affected the Lemurians in somewhat a negative way. What did they do wrong? Well, one of the things that they introduced potentially wrong was that the application of ageless wisdom in terms of all life was weighted too strongly towards the human side of life and not enough towards animals, plants, and pre-life minerals. So the society started to lose the balance it had during the fourth subrace, where that was really well understood, and it became pragmatic about the use of those things, animals and plants, in whatever way seemed most comfortable and best for just the humans, the Lemurians, without regard so much for the rest of life. We have some of that here today because we're in the fifth subrace of the fifth race. You know, this is the third race still that we're talking about, the fifth subrace of the third race, the Lemurians. So at any rate, the Venusians tended to stilt ageless wisdom. Remember, ageless wisdom doesn't mean it's all wisdom. Sometimes it's ageless mistakes, you know, and they did make some. Now, some of these mistakes also came in the way that they treated their students. The students were the humans, the Lemurians. They were the teachers, right? And sometimes their teaching was not balanced enough about the way that civilization should be developed and should be well-rounded. They were emphasizing the maniacic element, the mental side. But I know better, but I'm going to still do something that may not be right because, after all, I can get away with it. That's kind of what the fifth subrace remains as attitudinally developed. So much so that finally, some of the Pleiades folks and the Syrian folks came and said, "Hey, you guys, you Venusians, you're still doing it. You're going to mess up Earth if you keep going this direction. You've got to change this." And so they actually tutored and helped the Venusians to change some of what they were doing. So ageless wisdom took another shift away from just having as much as quickly as possible mental development at the cost of balancing the way that the Lemurians were taking care of the rest of their relationship, not so much with each other, but with, unfortunately, some other humans, in this case the beginning Atlanteans, and most importantly, with animals and plants. And so before they did too much harm to their island world, they got corrected. And sure enough, the sixth subrace started to develop from the fifth because of the shift. And they became very spiritual. As a matter of fact, they so corrected it, which is good, that they got a really good balance on things, better than the fourth subrace, which is good at balancing things. And they were able to actually co-serve. Some of these Lemurians were actually becoming arhats. They were becoming able to teach angels wisdom and able to do things that even the Venusians weren't so good at. And that was a big change. So suddenly the student becomes the teacher for the first time in human development on Earth. So this is a big change in angels wisdom now, because you no longer have angels wisdom just being taught by beings from another world. You got it being taught from the beings here, the human beings here. That's a huge change, right? And it really started pretty much with this conflict and the change from it, and the beginnings, therefore, of the sixth subrace. And so some of these humans in the sixth subrace became extremely developed, I mean, amazingly, and actually reached the state of becoming human teachers of ages with them, and became very spiritual in their approaches. And I'm talking about big teachers now. What is a big teacher? Well, a big teacher creates new concepts to teach so that people can understand things in better and better ways. The wisdom is expanded and not just taught as it is in a static condition. But so they're not teaching what others have taught them. They're teaching something that's creative in them. So anyway, some of these Lemurians became brilliant teachers and soon graduated before the end of the sixth subrace into the beginnings of the Earth spiritual hierarchy. They became the first humans from Earth to become members of a true spiritual hierarchy of Earth. They were still joined by the Venusian folks, who had already started a spiritual hierarchy on Earth, but they weren't indigenous to Earth, whereas these others were. Isn't that remarkable? That is, to me, it's remarkable anyway. So by 6 million years ago, you've got a spiritual hierarchy on Earth that is composed, in part, by humans that have advanced into the superhuman realm, become masters of the ageless wisdom. And become big teachers. And they're now part of this great new body. And I'm not talking about thousands of people here. I'm talking about dozens. But that's a lot, because even one at that early time would be a big deal. You talk about 5 or 10. That's a huge, amazing thing. We're talking about people who, you know, just a few million years before, were considered barely out of being animals. That's a big deal. A huge accomplishment in consciousness. And all because the Venusians made a mistake. The greater spiritual hierarchy of the constellations came in to try to stop what could be a train wreck. And sure enough, it reversed everything, and it turned out to be a good thing. So a little adversity sometimes does lead to a better situation. And that is really good. If you hold for a second, I'm going to just take a drink of this. I don't usually drink that much while I'm on the air, but boy, I'm speaking like crazy tonight. And you know what? If I keep going at this pace, I'm going to be out of all fluids I'm going to have to keep drinking, I think. All right, so let's continue on. This is real exciting stuff. I don't know if I hope you find it as interesting as I do, because I don't know where else you're going to read anything like this or hear anything about it. Okay, so the next thing that then occurs is that the Six Uprights establishes extremely good relations with the Atlanteans and becomes the mentors of the first subrace of Atlanteans. They actually helped them to establish a civilization, a political system, and to virtually develop themselves. Now, a lot of people say, well, where in the heck did the Atlanteans really come from then? Because that's a kind of a, like a hole in angels' wisdom. Nobody really knows why they just pop up somewhere or something. Boom, you know, they're there. Not really. This is going to surprise you. But what happened was that when there was a conflict in the fifth sub-race, and as the sixth sub-race was starting to be developed, there was a seed sub-race that was brought over to what would have been close to Atlantis. It wasn't exactly on the island of Atlantis, but it was close enough they could literally see Atlantis from. And it was really where we would consider to be Central South America, right, in that Colombia, you know, and Ecuador kind of area. And so, and then those folks moved out to some of the, you know, the West Indies, and eventually from there, it was easy to get from there to Atlantis. But at any rate, that seed group that was supposed to develop the subrace split. Half of them went. Now, this happened closer to 7 million years ago. Half of them went back to Lemuria, but the other half went to Atlantis and became the Atlanteans. Isn't that fascinating? Now, the thing is that's odd about this is there was supposed to be the sixth sub-race, but if you think about it, the Atlanteans were focused along the sixth race. So it was kind of like they were almost drawn to that continent because it was a sixth-ray landmass that we had a focus of that on it. And both of these landmasses were replacing the inundated by ice and water continent of Antarctica, which was, there was no life on. But there was some, obviously, you had some penguins and seals kind of life forms. Not exactly like they are today, but animals like that. But you didn't have human life at all capable of living there because it's just too cold and hostile. At any rate, so that's where the Atlanteans originated from. It was during that conflicted period when the six sub-race C group, part of them were pretty copacetic with the Venusians, and were, you know, like that was because it was the Venusians that it's always the next king that creates seed subgroups. So they were under the tutelage of them, but some of them couldn't stand them and said, you know what? These Venusians are getting this wrong. They're not balancing anything, and it's screwing things up. We're going to go our own way. And they literally did. And that's where the original Atlanteans came from. So they really were Lemurians, but they were almost not, because they rejected the civilization of Lemuria in favor of starting one away from some of the odd and wrong principles as purported by the Venusians. And, of course, once they went to Atlantis, and then this came from the more advanced, we'll call it hierarchies, spiritual hierarchies from other constellations, they were already set in stone. They were already living as different people. They actually changed in somewhat in appearance. They became somewhat smaller. Their brains became more capable of connecting, and therefore their astral nature came through better. They were their senses were more connected together. These were people who really were now Atlanteans. The seed group that went back to Lemuria became the spiritual group that were the ones that were part of we'll say, spiritually advanced six sub-race of Lemuria, and some of those became Arhats. Those folks had a natural inclination to be connected to the Atlanteans because they all were one at one point. And they went off to visit them. Some of them had relatives, you know. They were still friends. They split. They one went one way with the Venusians in control. And the other one said, hey, you know what? We're going off this way. We're going to do our own thing. And so they stayed in contact to some extent, as much as you can do across a half of the world. And that's how the connections grew between them. And it's fascinating because the Atlanteans did not have direct input coming from the spiritual hierarchy in their beginning first subrace. It came from the sixth subrace of the Lemurians, because the principle is the lowest should always be the one that is the teaching element first, not the highest, because otherwise you remove from the lowest its capability to grow. And so that's how it all worked out. And it also allowed the Atlanteans and Lemurians to live peaceably together. And it seemed like it was running very well, by the way. There was absolutely no reason to believe that this was going to go afoul. Now, it did, but I'll explain why. Okay, so eventually the Constellation folks, they pretty much said, hey, everything's going okay, we're going to leave Earth alone, let it do its own thing. And the Venusians were the true higher-level masters, and you had some, a few, a dozen or more, of human-level masters now that had advanced into the spiritual hierarchy. And then you had the starting, the beginning of the development of the seventh subrace. Well, that subrace should have been of a higher consciousness. It should have developed itself even further. It should have developed the ability to literally unify the etheric and physical bodies. It's a good thing, believe me, if you can unify them and completely make those senses work together. And it would have gone a long way to also having better, we'll say, connection with its astral nature. What happened? Well, a few bad things happened. It's hard to go into this without feeling a sense of almost remorse. Because I'm not saying we were all there. I happen to know I wasn't. But some people were there that aren't here today. The biggest problem that the seventh subrace of Lemurians had is that they started to believe, somewhat falsely in my opinion, that the more spiritually developed sixth subrace Lemurians were in some way separative in kind of too close with the Venusians. I shouldn't even use that word anymore, but we'll say with the spiritual hierarchy beings who were coming from the Venusian background. And they thought that they had an attitude of superiority. And some of them, even we could say almost the majority of the people that were Lemurians, started to believe that they were second class. They weren't spiritually developed. And they became hostile to ageless wisdom. Well, again, the more advanced masters were not the best teachers, because they came from Venus, and they again did not make the best choices in terms of teaching. That the best choices were made by the six subrace Lemurians that had advanced, but they still collectively weren't making the right decisions. Some of the decisions that were made were to try to have more structured teachings of ageless wisdom at a younger age. One would think that would be a good thing, right? Of the masses in the seventh subrace of the Lemurians. And that was one of the goals that was attempted. But that goal kind of backfired, because it didn't allow enough freedom for people living in all parts of Lemuria to choose whether or not that's what they wanted to do or not. And again, they already had this feeling that they were second class, that they were looked down upon, that they were not getting what they wanted from their world, from their physical world. And they also noticed that the six subrace people always seemed to have had all they needed, but they never wanted very much. Whereas the seven subrace people wanted a lot more in terms of the physical world. In general, they did, even if they were spiritual, they did. And the spiritual people in the seventh subrace were infinitely more successful than those who weren't. And because they had inclination to want more physical things in general, even if they were spiritual, and they were much more successful at getting them, this caused jealousies and a lot of what we'll call it envy. And the envy eventually turned into wars and battles among themselves to begin with. The battles are pretty extreme. And eventually the battles reached a point where the victors, and this is going to sound strange, but the victors were not the more spiritual people. They kept wanting to compromise and find some solution and not fight. But unfortunately, the other Lemurians had a different viewpoint, and they went in and took and then killed, but most of the time they enslaved. They began the practice of slavery. Now, the practice of slavery dehumanizes the overseers, and it causes them to lose their contact with God. And so this further separated the seven subrace from a few and fewer who weren't yet enslaved of spiritual people, and a large group of masses who had slaves and further were violent and destructive. Ageless Wisdom was not working very well, and the whole educational system failed, and they stopped even going to school completely. So they lost a lot of knowledge in the process, and they were not well educated any longer. And so the society de-evolved and became ruthless, destructive. And when there weren't enough slaves that could be garnered from what was left of anybody who was spiritual, then the Lemurians that were left, the big masses of Lemurians, said, hey, you know what, those Atlanteans that everybody had been visiting over there, why don't we go over there and enslave them? We need more slaves, and they got stuff, too, we can take. So, and besides, they got a nice world over there. We got a nice continent we could take care of. So they started invading Atlantis and taking slaves. Well, the Atlanteans just went completely berserk and decided that they have to do something to stop this. So they develop an army and fight and fight and fight. And this goes on for a couple million years. We're not talking about a small amount of time here. And in the meantime, the Atlanteans are becoming more developed, but under duress because the Lemurians keep coming over and capturing them, enslaving them, stealing their things, and generally killing them, too. And so this is a very bad thing. The only good thing to save the Atlanteans was that all of this evil that was brought in by the Lemurians brought about the destruction of Lemuria. It caused earthquakes, and eventually underneath the ocean, the ridge started to become very violent and open, and they started to lose their land mass, and many people were killed. This is what happens when evil takes over. The instability of the land itself is the victim, so to speak. Of course, it kills all life, not just human life. It's a terrible thing. At any rate, so Ageless Wisdom now in Lemuria has pretty much failed. But in Atlantis, it has succeeded in strange ways. First of all, the Atlanteans are being taught by, remember, the survivors of the six Lemurian subways, being taught that they should, at this point, not pay so much attention to the spiritual hierarchy. They were having some contact with them, but realize that evil was among them, that evil now was on Earth because of the seven subways of Lemurians, and that they needed to do something about it themselves. And on top of that, that Lemuria would be destroyed. So they knew even a million years before Lemuria was seriously inundated that it was going to go down the tubes because there was so much evil there. So they had that going for them. And then they knew that they were taught something else. They were taught by these great spiritual disciples. Some of them had now moved into the spiritual hierarchy as well and were trying to get the rest of the spiritual hierarchy to leave the Atlanteans alone because they were screwing up the Lemurians so much. And they taught the Atlanteans that their senses astral were so much superior to the Lemurians, they could win wars through astral, emotional means rather than just physical. Fighting toe-to-toe physically with the Lemurians was a losing proposition. They were bigger, stronger, and even had better weapons. So trying to beat them was not going to be an easy task. But using emotional methods of getting them to be afraid at the beginning of a battle, of developing tactics that we still use today, by the way, these emotive tactics were highly successful. Battle after battle, when they should never have had a chance, the Atlanteans started winning. This is happening 5 million years ago. And then moving into the 4 million year time, the island of Lemuria is falling apart. The Lemurians don't have as much resources. They're still coming over, still doing bad stuff. But now the Atlanteans are deciding it's time for us to become the ones who are attacking instead of just defending. And so they are going out and attacking these boats even before they get to Atlantis. They're attacking, on a few occasions at least, Lemuria itself, and they're doing a bang-up job. So much so that by about 3.5 million years ago, Lemuria is virtually off the map, and most of them are dead. Yeah. Or they're assimilated. Remember, even while this is going on, there are still some Lemurians, not very many, who are spiritual and come to Atlantis to live and desert Lemuria. And when they would, they bring as much technology as they could, as many weapons as they could, as much as they could contribute so that the Atlanteans could survive. So they were helped in that way as well. Again, ageless wisdom is evolving now. We're not just talking about winning based upon pure brute force. We're talking about all kinds of tactics. Probably the very first in spies and the very first in finding out all of the strategies of the enemy came into play. All of that came from these Lemurians that came to live in Atlantis. Also, the intermingling of the different races caused the Atlanteans to grow. They actually went from being like 5'5 to being like 6'2 in terms of the men and being much stronger. They actually grew bigger and had more physical strength. That's good because when you're dealing with 7 to 8 foot tall giants, you better have some way of dealing with them. I mean, even the arrows these giants were shooting were probably 4 or 5 feet long, you know, and probably an inch or two thick. When you're shooting little nothings at them, it's not going to work very well. All right, so the fascinating thing about this explanation of how ageless wisdom is changing is that it's historically now it's involved with concepts, unfortunately, of war and evil. Remember, until the seventh subrace of Lemuria, the concept of evil was virtually unknown. It didn't need to be taught because it didn't really exist. All of a sudden, you get this thing going, and boy, it's a madhouse. And good. It's a good thing that we had enough spiritually developed Lemurians, because without them, good chance the whole system would have failed and the planet would have gone dark right then. Possible. But it didn't. So that's the good news. And the Atlanteans won, eventually disabled, destroyed the evil element in the Lemurians, and the rest of them were absorbed into Atlantis. And Atlantis became a great people. The Atlanteans became a great people. Ageless Wisdom now took on a totally different, we'll say, bent. Just like the seventh subrace of Atlanteans rejected the teaching of Ageless Wisdom, the Atlanteans loved it. They couldn't get enough Ageless Wisdom. They wanted to learn much more about the other dimensions of time and space, particularly the astral dimension. They were very focused on six-ray stuff, and they loved to hear about it. They loved to know about it. They wanted to have communication with people in the astral world. They wanted to astral travel. They wanted to have inventions that were in the astral world become inventions in their world. And they did, by the way, get that. But at the same time, they were spiritual. They were interested in God. They wanted to balance their civilization in a way that God was representing goodness in the ways that they lived. And this was true of the first, second, third, and fourth sub-races of Atlanteans. They were amazing people. If anybody was successful, it was them. Particularly the fourth sub-race of Atlanteans probably is our idea of utopia or heaven. Now, they weren't perfect. They still were people. They were still human beings. But they were amazingly spiritual. They lived as virtuously as probably anybody has ever lived, except for possibly the sixth sub-race Lemurians, the ones that were really successful. They were the most spiritual. But the Atlanteans were better in general for the whole society at taking it out of just the few and making it a general state of how everybody was living on average. And Ageless Wisdom became a generally applied way of living, more so than any other time in history. So the fourth subrace became like hugely successful at making Ageless Wisdom the hallmark of life. And it looked like things were going to go really good. As a matter of fact, if we were betting back then, you know, like 2 million years ago or so, and especially leading up to 1 million years ago, from 2 million to 1 million, you would say the world's going to be perfect. The system's going to beat evil. It's going to win. It's really there. You really would think that. Yep. Well, you see, there's a problem. You still had the heads of the spiritual hierarchy coming from the Venusian stock. I don't want to be too lambasting on them, but they still didn't quite get what they did wrong on Venus. And despite everything they were doing good, they still overemphasized certain monastic principles, not balancing with love very well, nor with even etheric physical virtues of coordination of communications with each other and cooperation and sharing. They weren't good at these things. They were just really better at the more monastic elements of existence. Well, that's all well and good, but I got to tell you, you know, you'd think after these many millions of years, these folks would get it right, and I guess they just got stuck. Because when you don't live long enough physically, because your world's destroyed, it has such a terrible effect on balancing all the parts of a person, what makes a human being human, that it's hard to get it straight. And that's what they were dealing with. You say, well, they're here physically, then why can they? Well, yes. They did do some incarnating, actually. But they were pretty bad at it. They ended up screwing up things because of that. There was actually attempts to correct themselves by doing some level of physical incarnation, we'll call it that, where they're supposed to have the three joined bodies in unison because they're masters of the ageless wisdom, right? But they, when they did that, they oftentimes would fall victim to either their astral or their physical natures or both. And sometimes they were downright selfish, especially in relationships with people of the opposite sex, which is most of them were men, so they were having relations with women who were earthly human. Not so good. And so you have a lot of issues going on here that comes from the fact that ageless wisdom explains things pretty darn well, but it doesn't guarantee any kind of outcomes because God says everything has to be free. And if it's going to destroy itself, it will. If it's going to do this bad, it's going to do it. This is the true hallmark of a total system of freedom. Oh, yes, there's some things that are absolute. There's no question about that. But the absolutes give so much freedom that to a human being, they don't really stop anything that's evil. Okay, so here is the bottom line of this whole situation. Even though the fourth subrace of Atlanteans were amazing at getting ageless wisdom down, they were really great. As the fifth subrace started to develop, the seed race particularly, but then the whole race itself, in crept, again, this overemphasis on the mental side and knowledge being superior to the balance of knowledge with love and knowledge with, which would make wisdom, by the way, and knowledge with, we'll say, intelligent coordinated response, which is the virtue of the physical world, which would give great cooperation and sharing. So the fifth subrace comes in, and the students, it's mostly the students now of some of these masters, some of them Venusian, and these students start getting too much knowledge from their teachers without first gaining enough consciousness. If you get too much knowledge and not enough consciousness, you turn out being egotistical and lacking love over time, especially if you become arrogant. And then you don't have any wisdom. So you're knowledgeable but unwise. Well, knowledgeable and unwise people in an advanced society become extremely dangerous because they turn the society inside out. They grab a hold of the power that is capable in a society that's pretty well developed, and they turn it on the society itself for their own edification and for the damage, unfortunately, fellow humans, eventually leading to evil. And this is what happened. Let's take a little break for right now. I'm going to take another drink, and then I'm going to tell you about something else. Okay, I'm back. Now, I wanted to mention, in case you didn't know about this, a lot of people don't that are listening to me because they're not around physically where I'm at, that there's going to be a Life's Hidden Meaning study group. That's that textbook I wrote that's sort of like a great doorstop. It's about 4 pounds, and you can do a lot with it. You could also read it. And there's going to be a group forming of a study group. Now, I've taught a bunch of these, actually, probably. I don't even know the number, maybe 8 or 10 of them or so. And I've also helped other groups that were studying it in larger numbers than that, even over the phone and other places. And this is going to be physically here locally, but because we now have all the technologies and everything, you can participate in this group. We eventually will have cameras and stuff, but right now we're probably just going to have it so you can listen in and talk and that sort of thing, speakerphone thing. But they're very good sounding, and it's almost like being there. And it's going to be on Wednesday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. Now, that is Phoenix time. Phoenix time is the same as California time right now. That's kind of weird, isn't it? We don't go on daylight savings time because nobody wants more sun in Phoenix. We've kind of get enough of it during the summertime. So a little bit more early in the morning when people are sleeping is okay, and then let it go down a little earlier. So that's what we do. Now, some people in other places say the opposite in the summer, and they want to have more sun, so obviously they go on daylight savings time, not us. So 7 to 9 is like California time or Pacific time. We're not on mountain daylight savings time. We are on mountain time, but we don't go on daylight savings time, so it's like we shift to Pacific time during about almost 8 months of the year. The rest of the time in the wintertime, we're on mountain time. So the time is going to kind of change depending upon where you are. You have to think about that because we're asking you to make a commitment, a weekly commitment to be present as for virtually every one of these meetings from 7 to 9 p.m. Phoenix time or Arizona time for 12 months starting on, well, this says starting sometime at the end of July, I think, or maybe the beginning of August. We're not sure. We'll start date will be announced soon. We'll talk about it. But we're going to make a decision this Sunday. So this is your opportunity to join. It might be a little early. I hope that maybe if someone wants to join in and it's a week after that, they can still do so. But think about it. So if we go past the 14th of July, which is just coming up, you could still probably contact us and get involved. You can call us toll-free, 800-777-7850. Anyone can participate by phone conferencing from anywhere, provided you have a phone that you can call in on. That's it. That's all you need is just to have a phone. And it could be a cell phone. It could be a regular phone, that kind of thing. And we'll let you know what the start date is in the near future. Okay, so that's a Life's Hidden Meaning study group, and I'll be teaching it. And if you want to know more, give us a call. I'll say that number one more time, 800-777-7850, and it's up on the website, so you can find it somewhere on the Ageless Wisdom website. I think it may be on the station website, too. You can check it out. Okay, we're going back to the history of Ageless Wisdom. And, oh, my God, I got 30 minutes. That's all I've got left. Oh, God, this is going to be quick. All right. This should be a two-part show, huh? Well, Ageless Wisdom is a big history, so you can imagine I'm trying to do it in a short time. All right. So anyway, bad news for Ageless Wisdom because during the fifth sub-race, it really started taking a turn for the worse. It wasn't for a few hundred thousand years, but it just started to really melt down. And you can ask yourself, well, why does it take so much time? Well, because consciousness is growing very slowly. And if it was growing much at all in some people's minds, way back during the fourth race, of Atlanteans, because that race was focused not so much on the mental, but on the astral body. So consciousness grows fastest when it's mental. And that's, I guess, why the Venusians thought that the answer is just do it mental and forget about everything else. They didn't have it right then. I hope they got it right now. But anyway, the result was disaster, naturally. It allowed evil to come back in. By the sixth sub-race, evil was going full steam, and all kinds of terrible things happened. Ageless Wisdom started to become rarer in terms of its teaching. People paid less and less attention to it, or more interested in physical pleasure, in astral travel, even in dying. I didn't mind dying. Well, we're going to go live in the astral world. That sounds cool. So people were not very concerned about living. They didn't live nearly as long. Life expectancy dropped by less than half. Lots of bad things happened. And speaking of life expectancy, very quickly, I just mentioned that Atlanteans were living like over 100 years of time. We think we're long lived today. They were outliving us by far. Some of them were living in the 120s. But then it dropped drastically because of the selfishness, which is what always happens, by the way. And as evil takes over, life diminishes. That's what it wants, and that's what it gets. Right. So the fascinating part about all this is that here is a great opportunity that was just totally lost. And reason today we struggle in even understanding ageless wisdom, much less finding out much about it, is because it was almost eradicated. Because during the sixth sub-race, things got so bad that ageless wisdom was barely taught. And during the seventh sub-race, things got much worse, and one out of four people turned evil. Well, that's a number that's intolerable. And it was either going to end the world or you had to end the Atlanteans. Well, the spiritual hierarchy, along with even higher beings, decided to end the Atlantean continent. And most of you know about that. And so, unfortunately, you know, you go back about 11,000 years ago, and Atlantis was destroyed. But it was destroyed in a very fast way that took hundreds of thousands of years to take place in Lemuria. So if things get real bad, what can happen in 100,000 years can take place literally overnight. So it was bad. It was really bad. But it did go down in chunks and pieces here and there over 100,000 years. But the very end was totally cataclysmic. It was like the end of the world almost kind of thing. And so much of ageless wisdom was destroyed that was what was left was this. It was decided had to be hidden in an unusual way. And so for some people, they don't really get this. They don't understand what that way is because they think that that's normal, you know. So I'm going to tell you it's not normal because normal would be what was done for millions of years. This is normal, what was done for the last 10,000 years, which is a whole different kind of thing. But that's what would people think today. So we could look at it as being mysticism or mystified. Now, what is mysticism? Ageless wisdom, basically, is a mental with astral and etheric physical understandings of how the universe works. It's about us understanding, being conscious of God and how it works and creates and how that's, you know, what I talked about earlier, and then how the whole universe works, which is the cosmology of it. So you got these two coming together, and it's a good thing. But when you mystify, that goes away. Everything I said earlier that ageless wisdom is supposed to be is kind of put aside. And instead, ageless wisdom becomes what you can feel, mostly feel, and intuit in that feeling of ageless wisdom, and then eventually think about. It's a weird kind of way of looking at it. So it isn't balanced between mind and feeling and action. It's interaction. It's all kind of almost overboarded into feeling and into faith and into belief in God rather than understanding of God. Now, belief in God isn't terrible. I'm not going to tell you that it's a really bad thing. Most of you started off, if you don't still believe in God, you believe that way, right? But it's it has many failings. And the first is that it tends to breed atheism. Now, why does it do that? Because atheists use the mental body against the belief in God to disprove to themselves that God exists. And it opens the door to the worst kinds of evil, which is what Earth is supposed to be fighting against. So mysticism is an odd thing to decide to use as a cure, well, at least an alleviating, of the terrible consequences of a failed root race of Atlanteans. So you got to ask yourself, why would they do this? Why don't they choose something else? Well, there was nothing left. You see, once you destroy most of the knowledge, because the knowledge became toxic, that became used to destroy others. If you don't have knowledge, you can't develop the full wisdom of Angel's wisdom. You can't get there. Knowledge has to be joined with love to get wisdom. And that's where you, and without the wisdom, you can't lead to the light of the inner world, which is of truth. So you hide the truth when you create mysticism, but you also hide the truth of evil when you do that. That's bad. And you also hide the ability for evil to grow. You slow down evil. Now, how does it slow down evil? Because without the knowledge, evil has to start all over again like everyone else. And if it's a horse race, evil usually loses in that kind of contest. So the Ageless Wisdom folks, which was spiritual disciples and human masters of Ageless Wisdom, along with the Venusians, all of them got together. And it came up with mysticism as being the best compromise, not a great answer, but the best compromise, because it's going to make a horse race, at least, out of who can regain knowledge and apply it with wisdom to gain truth. It's known that at certain points, using propaganda or spin or whatever we want to call it today, evil would eventually have the upper hand. But it was figured that that wouldn't take place until nearly the 20th century. Guess what? And that during that time, humans would have the ability to regain the knowledge of some aspects of Ageless Wisdom, some truths, enough so that they could possibly get the upper hand over evil, but there would be a big contest about it. Sound biblical? Yeah. The Bible is really a conglomeration of Ageless Wisdom ideas. Okay. At any rate, so mysticism became the path, and many spiritually inclined people went towards mysticism because that was the only way you could get any knowledge of Ageless Wisdom. It was just, there was no other. And everything else was kept hid, and it was destroyed, deliberately destroyed. Tremendous amounts of knowledge was destroyed. Some of it was, from time to time, kept, but only a few could get to it. And then those places got destroyed, like the library in Alexandria had a lot of Ageless Wisdom stuff and whew, gone. And a lot of times it was evil that was destroying knowledge because it knew at that time it couldn't use propaganda yet to get the upper hand. So it figured it would keep the horse race more on its side by getting rid of the knowledge. It didn't need knowledge to destroy life, and it could keep destroying life and thought that it could win the world that way through fear and through subjection and enslavement, etc. And so we figured that was its best move, and it did exactly that with great success at times. Brutal, horrible things were done. But over time, the good side was still keeping up because there was still enough coming through the mysticism that crept out of the mysticism into real wisdom that people were getting wiser. And some leaders were getting wiser. And some great leaders existed. Karaj, a leader that was taught Zoroastrianism, which is a form of Ageless Wisdom, mostly mystical, became somewhat non-mystical and applied some of this non-mystical, more knowledge-based, started opening up schools in Persia and elsewhere, adopted some democratic principles, went to personally visited Greece and other places to understand how they were starting to develop democracy. He had plans to do even more, but unfortunately, you only lived to almost the age of 50, and boom, goodbye. So the thing is that those kinds of people were eventually making headway. But remember the contest. The contest is you got to get to the point where before propaganda can be used and effectively, you've got to have enough light in the world and enough people can see darkness or evil, especially when it's available, or when it's there, I should say, not available, when it's doing its thing. so they could recognize it. So we come to, through the ages, you know, I've seen recent programs on the Knights Templar. They were a third-rate group trying to mitigate the Sixth Ray, because the Sixth Ray had become so faith-based and was fighting against mysticism. They were very mystical, but they hid it, and they used the technology, banking especially, everything about with the Third Ray in military. They became great military strategists, tremendous bankers, huge at doing all kinds of big business. They weren't small shop owners, but they were big business. And they were terrific at everything. But what they were doing is they were mysticists that were applying the mysticism in practical ways to knowledge. They invented everything from coins to and money exchange to checking accounts and banking systems that were really useful. And they also improved weapons of war. And they improved the commerce society in general, and the most important thing they did is they mitigated some of the overly zealous faith-based practices of the then Christian Church, the Catholic Church. Seemed like a good thing at the time, except there was a reaction against them. And in 1307, they became enemies of the Catholic Church. And in October, Friday the 13th, that's where that comes from, they were hunted down, and most of them fled, and a number of them were killed, like 5,000 were killed, but there was hundreds of thousands of them left. Some of them went to Scotland, others came to what we call North America, the United States. They lived here for a while. But at any rate, this whole thing was an attempt to take mysticism and use it in ways to demystify in regular amounts. Now, the 20th century brought about the greatest change because, unfortunately, by the time we reached the 20th century, radio especially, and then, of course, recorded sound and pictures, all of those things became instruments of propaganda. And evil just now took its place and said, We've covered our tracks. Most people don't see us in time. We'll take over the world. They tried that through World War I and II, especially World War II, and they were almost successful at it. And then they tried it throughout the Cold War, and they were almost successful at it. And now they're trying it today, and they are being successful at it. So you have to realize that the only thing that will undo this process is to demystify ageless wisdom and teach it to people so they can see evil and so they can also create a more spiritual and virtuous life much more quickly, because there's very little time left before the world will be taken over by evil. And this horse race is right down to the... It's neck and neck and on its way, and it's terrible. Everyone that I know of would prefer it not to be this way, but that's the way it is. And ageless wisdom, unfortunately, has become we'll say discredited in every way possible, from calling it cultism to the occult, which just means hidden. Cultism is hidden for bad purposes, which is also a nonsense thing. But in terms of ageless wisdom, it is. I mean, are there cults? Sure. People hide themselves for all kinds of dark reasons. But people in ageless wisdom don't. People in ageless wisdom are trying to unhide the truth. But evil always reverses the principles in ageless wisdom. It reverses the truth. And oddly, the opposite of truth is some of the hardest things to see as being evil. If you can completely reverse the truth, as evil that is really big evil can successfully do, it becomes virtually invisible to people who are not familiar with ageless wisdom and who aren't very spiritual. The good news is that faith-based spirituality still can see some elements of evil. The problem is it doesn't know what to do about it. It wants to still go back to the earlier ages and fight emotionally and fight physically. But the fight isn't there. The fight's in the mental world. And evil's winning. The fifth subworld is the mental plane, where the fight is going. And it's beating the faith-based folks because they don't know how to fight there. They need truth to do it. And you've got to be wise in its application. It requires ageless wisdom. And that's the problem. The demystification of ageless wisdom is what I'm trying to do. And the people that I'm associated with and spiritually focused are trying to do. And maybe the rest of you who are listening to me maybe have some inkling or thought about doing it. And so that's what is the answer. I don't know of any other answer that will work because it was designed like this. This is what we're in right now was understood millions of years ago as being the problem and the things we're going to face, particularly at least a million years ago. It became evident that this battle, as we have it today, was going to happen. I know that's hard to understand because, for a lot of people, we think a million years ago there weren't even human beings as we understand them. That's not true, though. And so, hopefully you can understand from today how ageless wisdom has really changed. Now, it went from being taught in piecemeal as it was applicable to the development of humans, to eventually being fully widely understood and taught and lived at the level that people could respond to it and could have consciousness about it, to becoming abused and destroyed in some ways, and becoming reversed and eventually put aside. And then it was hidden. It became the occult. It became mystified. And it's been like that for 10,000 years. That's a long time. And so the process, and it actually started about 13,000 years ago, but the process has been intensely in effect for 10,000 years. And so now you have the only way to solve the horse race that we're losing with evil is to demystify ageless wisdom, which was supposed to start when? Well, it was supposed to start about 20 years ago. And when I say start, I mean in full swing. And it's been stopped by mostly by the movement of atheistic thought coupled with political, we'll call it methodologies, which include certain parts of progressivism, we'll call it socialism, and in particular communism. These have come together to be able to stifle the development because they correctly, in terms of evil's viewpoint, went after education. First, they started at the highest levels of education and have worked their way down to preschool now. And as they teach atheism in one way or another, they may not call it that, but that's what it is, and they teach anti-ageless wisdom, untruth, and they reverse it completely from the truth, they are indoctrinating people to become used to evil at a very young age. This has been going on for at least 20 years in full swing and 30 to 40 years overall. So you should be aware that this is not something that just happened yesterday. And with the advent of communication at the level it is today, and with the crystallization of the means of communication, it makes it easier for darkness to use it in bad ways. It allows people to become convinced very quickly of false ideas, including the most atrocious untruths, with the most atrociously bad things being done by people in leadership positions, with nobody taking notice or even caring. Unbelievable stuff is happening daily, every day. hear it on the news, I watch it, and most people are unaware of it. And some of it is not even reported very much. So it's an amazing array of a conglomerate of anti-wisdom, anti-ageless wisdom, and anti-truth that's being created, which is anti-God. And it makes sense because almost all the people doing this are atheists at heart. They may not tell you that. Heck, the President of the United States says that he's presently a Christian. Just happens to go to a church, to churches, we'll say, that espouse communism and anti-individuality, even in connection with soul and God. Doesn't believe in the Constitution of the United States, although he's the guy who swears that he's going to uphold it. And on. I mean, it goes beyond, way beyond that. So we look at these things and we have to say to ourselves, well, if those kinds of people are, you know, closet atheists who basically prefer the systems of Islam to what we'll call Western ideas and support it in every way possible throughout the world, that is a very, very serious issue. Not that there's anything wrong with people who claim on a faith-based issue that they get to God through Islam, but that we're not talking about faith in terms of God. We're talking about lifestyle and philosophy of life and governance. That's extreme Islamists. Those are the people who maybe 15-20% Muslims, maybe not. I don't know. The numbers seem to be running all over the place. Whatever it is, it's still a lot of people. If there were a billion people, it's 200 million, so I mean, that's a lot of people. In any case, the issue here is that ageless wisdom should correct us, but only if it is demystified and taught and heard in ways by people with open enough minds at this point to at least get some of it. I'm doing what I can to do that, but the question is, what can you do about it? I hope that tonight's show has led you to an understanding of a history. I couldn't cover it very well. I apologize, but it really would have taken a much longer show to go through the whole thing. You know, there's a lot more to talk about than would have revealed more about it. But you got a flavor. The point is that any of you out there who are listening to me, you can be ambassadors of ageless wisdom. You can tell people about this show and anything else you've read or heard that they may be able to access, or what you already understand yourself, because it's critical that if we're going to save this world and make it into the kind of place I think most people want to live in, we're going to all have to be involved in this on an individual level. Yes, you should join a group of people that are doing it. I absolutely encourage you to do that. But even so, it's incumbent upon each of us as individuals to still carry this way on in our life as well, and to talk about it freely with everybody we can, even though it might be a little uncomfortable, or somebody might think you're a wacko, or somebody might think you're bad. They might claim you're evil. Hell, I got people claiming I'm evil almost every day. If you think I'm evil, then obviously you wouldn't have been listening to tonight's show. But the point is that the weird thing about this, the weird thing about this is that everything is upside down. Now, I don't want to go out and just wipe out every evil person. I want to get every evil person to find truth. But evil people will never find truth as long as they win a horse race against ageless wisdom. You see, in order for them to find truth in the physical world, they have to encounter force from the rest of us. The force doesn't have to be like, I'm going to kill you. The force, in many cases, if it stays mental, is mental truth against mental falsity. And when the truth wins out, there is force involved, but it isn't the kind that directly destroys a person's body or their home or whatever. it just destroys their ideation. Somewhat in other people who are reflecting and seeing reflection in equal amounts or more in those that are evil. Destroying ideas in people who are evil, that have evil ideas, allows them freedom to find their soul again. Yes, they may be detached from their soul completely, but they may start looking for it when their ideation falls on deaf ears and they can't get any energy, especially mental energy, from anyone else. When nobody else will give the time of day to an evil person, even if they have a gun in their hand, they're pretty disabled. You'll be amazed at how quickly they lose the fight, so to speak, when everyone else says, you know what, you're just evil and you're talking falsities. You're just lying your butt off, and we know it. Once that comes through, no matter what they've got as a physical weapon, they're defeated. In today's world, and if it's done in mass, if one person or two people do it, they don't care. They go by the masses. They steal energy on a mental level from all the people who are fooled by them, all the people who buy the nonsense, who buy the lies and accept them. That's what gives them the energy to go on, mentally speaking. If you suck that out of their sails, although they may still have some astral energies, they're stealing from astral folks, of course, or astral bodies, and from physical, they can't survive in the world as it is today. They could have 1,000 years ago, there's no question of that, but not today. The world's changed too much. The technology is such that it makes it almost impossible for them to win the fight. They will lose, and they know it. I hope this has made some sense. Talking about ageless wisdom is like talking about everything in the universe in one breath. It's pretty big. I hope you've gotten the idea that there's a lot more about this. You might want to read some of the stuff I've written. You may want to listen. I'll still talk about this subject, not necessarily the exact same show again, but I'll go into some of the things that I've left out tonight in other shows so that you can fill in the gaps. Because beyond the ending of the Atlantean period, there's a whole bunch else to talk about that's more familiar to people. But maybe you can find that out for yourself, because some of that is already historically accounted for. And maybe that's a good challenge for y'all. All right, listen, we are out of time. And again, I want to mention about that study group. If you're interested in that, it's a good thing to participate in. Learn a lot more about how you can help other people by learning and understanding ageless wisdom even better than you can listening to, say, a radio show, or maybe just reading it alone. There's a lot more to understand. And if you want, I'm going to give that phone number one more time, 800-777-7850. Call that number if you're interested in participating in a study group, 7 to 9 p.m. on Wednesday evenings, sometime starting in about a month or so. Okay, we're out of time for now, and until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.